Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Well, hello, welcome to NucleCast. This is Jim Howe, your guest host, filling in for Dr. Adam Laufer. We have a very special guest today. It's Dr. Adam Laufer, who's welcome back to your show.
We're here to talk about
a very intriguing piece that you've written with your colleague Colonel Curtis McGiffin. It's called Dynamic Parity, A New Approach to American Nuclear Deterrence. It's a fascinating read. I recommend everyone give it a go. What we'd like to do is kind of set the scene, though. Where are we today with America's nuclear deterrence? What is our posture? Just very briefly, for any of our listeners who might not be up to speed on American current policy.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question, and it's one that's hard to gauge because we're actually seeing a lot of a shift. You know, we've had American nuclear posture, particularly since the end of the Cold War, has shifted with presidencies. And so you tend to have Republican presidencies who sort of are more supportive of modernization and the continued maintenance and employment fielding of the force. And then, you know, you'll have a Democrat presidency who will tend to favor arms control and reductions more. And so you've sort of seen this normal ebb and flow. And, you know, in 2010, as part of the agreement between Senator Kyle of Arizona and President Obama, there was an agreement that the Senate would ratify New START, which has sort of been this major limiting factor on arsenals, or on strategic nuclear arsenals between the U.S. and Russia for 15 years. And in return for, ratifying that treaty, President Obama said, well, I'll modernize all three legs of the triad. And now we're essentially 15 years later. We haven't fielded anything yet, but we're getting close. We've got some warhead upgrades and we've got all sorts of stuff. The NNSA is incredibly busy. But nuclear policy is now, in the last 2 years since the invasion of Russia with China's breakout, you know, the 2022 NPR was going to eliminate the hedge and was, you know, we were looking at these arms control efforts, and with Russia's withdrawal from New START, or suspension, let's call it a suspension, nuclear policy is in flux right now. And you just had Pranay Vaadi, who's the Biden administration's guy on the National Security Council, who gave a speech at the Arms Control Association in June, which was essentially, hey, constituency of the Biden administration, reality is now overcoming our idealism and our aspirations. And so it's not going to quite be what you wanted. And then, of course, you had a speech, I think the 1st of August, Vipin Narang, who was the acting assistant secretary of defense for space, which has the nuclear portfolio. And, you know, Vipin came in as sort of a nuclear minimalist. But now he went, of course, gave a speech at CSIS as he was leaving and said, hey, we may have to go larger. And so you're seeing in an administration that came in wanting to reduce the role, reduce numbers, eliminate the hedge, they're now at the end of that administration saying we're going to have to grow. And then as we look to the next administration, we're probably, depending on whether it's Trump or whether it's Harris, we're going to see a more robust growth and role for nuclear weapons. And how robust it is will largely depend on who wins that election. And so it's dynamic right now, and it's changing. But we're sort of seeing just reality and the Russia, China, North Korea, potentially Iran threat, driving both Republicans and Democrats to say, hey, we need more. We need more capability, more numbers. And, you know, we've got to be able to effectively deter. And so that's kind of where we are right now.
So let me stitch together two questions. You know, first, you say that in your article that over the last 70 years, our deterrent posture has really helped prevent, you know, large-scale global wars. It's actually led to a period of relative peace and prosperity for pretty much the whole world. But things are changing. We now have China, Russia, North Korea, maybe potentially Iran at some point, are really kind of upsetting the apple cart. Could you kind of talk about how things have changed and what the ramifications of that are?
Well, let me start by saying there's sort of a misperception about what nuclear weapons are good for. And for advocates of arms control and disarmament, they say, hey, listen, the only thing nuclear weapons really do is nuclear weapons deter the use of nuclear weapons. And so you just get rid of the nuclear weapons and then you don't have to deter the use of other nuclear weapons. But that's not in actuality really what nuclear weapons do. It's one of the things, but nuclear weapons also prevent great power conflicts. I mean, we didn't go to World War III in the Cold War for a reason. It was because of the nuclear arsenals of the United States and the Soviet Union. And lest we forget, in the 20th century, great power wars, you know, were responsible. Not only they killed about 70 million people just in the conflict, 70 to 90 million people. And I mean, Russia was devastated. And Russia was devastated by the Nazis, but Europe as a whole was devastated and came back after that war as a very different country. It is not the powerhouse today that it was then, prior to World War I and II. So nuclear weapons prevent that. But then you got to look at what also happened because of those great power wars. Well, we saw World War I led to the creation of the Soviet Union. And then you saw the deaths of tens of millions of people in Russia because of that. And then you saw communism spread across Eastern Europe. And then, you know, because of World War II, you saw the rise of the Chinese Communist Party. And, you know, Mao Zedong killed at least 30 million of his own people. So you've got all of these follow-on effects that if you can prevent those great power wars, and I think Keith Payne says that those great power wars happen 4 to 6 times a century on average. So if you can eliminate those, you eliminate all of this death, you know, and the numbers are about 2% of global population has a tendency to die because of conflicts every year. That number's now down to like 0.1%. So a lot fewer people are dying. And so this is a big thing that nuclear weapons do. Nuclear weapons also prevent wars of your allies. So the U.S. has allies, and those allies generally fight their neighbors that they disagree with and have fights with. Well, because we're a nuclear armed nation and we have these allies, we're constraining our allies from fighting the people they don't like. So it's not just the people we don't like. This is part of the reason why conflict-related deaths has gone from this sort of average of about 2% per year down to 0.1%. It's because it's not only great power wars, it's these secondary wars that have ended. And then there's another big thing that I never hear anybody talk about when it comes to the role of nuclear weapons. And if you look at what they do, first of all, by virtue of reducing conflict, if you think about World War II, at the height of World War II, 50% of American GDP was spent on the war effort. 50 cents of every dollar went to the war. That means you're not spending money on other things. You're not doing productive things that make the country wealthier and more prosperous. And then when you don't have nuclear weapons, you're preparing to fight that next war. So defense expenditures tend to be a lot higher. So not only are wars expensive, I mean, look at Iraq and Afghanistan. That was a $7 to $10 trillion conflict, and that wasn't even a big one. And that's money we don't have to spend elsewhere. So the important thing to also think about is that nuclear weapons reduce what you spend on wars because they go down, and defense spending, and then that money is reallocated to all these other things. You know, we have money to invest in the creation of things like Google, and you know, we as individual Americans pay lower taxes, and so therefore I can buy that, I haven't bought it yet, but that Ford Raptor F-150 that I've been eyeing, you know, because we're wealthier now, I can think about having a Ford Raptor, whereas I couldn't have thought about it if we were constantly fighting wars and spending our GDP on that. And so that's an important thing to do. And you allow technology. When has technology flourished? Well, it's flourished since the end of World War II. And that's not solely, but in part, that's because nuclear weapons have enabled that. So that's what they do. Now, the fear today is that we won't have the ability to keep this going. Because if you don't have an arsenal that is sufficient to deter, you know, a triumvirate, you've got, you know, an autocracy triumvirate in Russia, China, and North Korea. And, you know, the Iranians are hanging around. I think the Iranians are not declaring themselves a nuclear state because they fear the Israelis will strike them with their nuclear weapons. They don't quite know what the Israelis are going to do. So they're hanging back. But you've gotten the Russians, Chinese, and North Koreans who have said, hey, we think America's in decline. We don't think they have the chutzpah anymore to actively, you know, engage us and push us back. And so they're poking and they're prodding. They're waiting to see what we do. And that's really part of what this problem is today. And for us, you know, we have not decided to build a nuclear arsenal that clearly demonstrates to the Russians, Chinese, and North Koreans that there is no capability gap we won't fill, because we've got capability gaps that they're filling and they think they'll use to their advantage. And you're not going to outproduce us. And we've not said that yet. We're always looking for, you know, alternatives to actually having to essentially rebuild the Manhattan Project for the 21st century. And that's really the challenge we're facing right now.
So you propose a new deterrence paradigm. You call it dynamic parity. Could you just walk us through the basic tenets of what that's all about?
Yeah, so dynamic parity is really this concept that Curtis McGiffin sort of fathered and I, you know, helped him develop. And essentially, dynamic parity seeks to do four things. It wants to create a balance of nuclear capability between what we call the axis of autocracies and the United States. And we want to prevent those autocracies collectively, not individually, but collectively, from having superiority over the United States. So the idea is we're going to create an arsenal of essentially equivalent size and sets of capabilities to the collective of Russia, China, and North Korea. We're going to treat them as one. And we're not going to take into account, you know, the small arsenal of the British or the French. They're not going to be included. So it's us, the Americans, versus them. And then the second thing, we want to enhance extended deterrence by assuring our allies that as the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans grow, we're going to grow too. Now, if the Russians, now part of dynamic parity, this is the dynamic part, is if the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans say, hey, we want to shrink our arsenal. We challenged you. You stepped up to the challenge. We want to shrink. Then we'll say, hey, let's verify and let's shrink. So it's, you know, the point here is not to ensure an arms race, but what it does is it tells your adversary, you're not going to outgrow us. You just won't. We will keep up. And it creates this is the sort of the third thing it does, is it creates a framework for managing the growth or the decline in operationally deployed nuclear weapons. And it does it in the absence of arms control. Because our basic premise is you don't have to have arms control. Arms control is an industry. You know, it exists for its own sake. You've got lots of jobs. You got lots of money in, that go into the arms control industry. It has its own degree programs. And of course, it wants to, you know, ensure its own survival. But we say, hey, you don't have to have it. And you can achieve the those things that are beneficial we get out of it. Like arms control does have things that are beneficial because it means we in the, you know, the Soviets, we talked a lot. And we and the Russians, we talked a lot and we got to know each other and understand each other better. That was sort of what we think is a key benefit of it. Well, you can do that through other means. And you don't have to have this arms control industry that we have today. Now, the fourth thing is that dynamic parity informs the configuration and size of the American nuclear arsenal. And that's because essentially what we say is Russia, China, North Korea, whatever number and capability set you build, we will essentially build something similar. It doesn't have to be the exact same number. I mean, we might rely on bombers a little more where they rely on you know, ballistic missiles. They might build a nuclear-powered megaton torpedo, and we might not do that. So you don't have to have exactly the same number in the exact same type of weapons, but you essentially create something similar. And the reason you do that is because the human brain understands, it understands what is similar, right? So symmetry is really important. So for example, there are studies, and this is, it's sort of slightly off topic, but humans judge the attractiveness of others based on the symmetry of their face. So if your face is more symmetrical, then you're deemed, you know, more attractive. But this principle of symmetry, it's dramatically more influential than just, you know, is somebody pretty or not. If you think about how humans act, we tend to, you know, aggregate in groups of, you know, people of similar, you know, similar race, similar culture, similar. We're always looking for similarity because we gravitate to similarity. And it's because we understand similarity. And so dynamic parity essentially wants to create an understanding with your adversary that, hey, we're going to match your capability. We will be similar because you understand what you think your capability can do. When you build your nuclear force, you know what that means. Well, we're going to build the nuclear force that's similar to yours. And so if you know what your nuclear force can and will do, you'll understand what our nuclear force can and will do. Now, some would argue, hey, why don't you just have nuclear superiority? Because superiority is better. And I would say, in principle, I agree with you. But one thing the Cold War taught us is that, you know, Secretary of Defense Harold Brown, you know, he famously said, you know, we build, they build, we stop, they build. And so there comes a point at which when you've got 30,000 to 25,000, right, that we got to this point where they had like 34 and we had 25. And we just said, okay, we're at the point where we'll stop now because, you know, building 34 instead of 25, that really won't have a qualitative or a quantitative advantage for us. And so we stopped. And so you have to be careful about what does superiority mean to you and to your adversary. And so we think, particularly as you're in these few thousand numbers, that having sort of a similar capability is sufficient. And what we don't think is sufficient is there's a concept that's gaining some widespread usage, and that's strategic sufficiency. And that essentially says, hey, we just need to have enough to be able to take out our adversary's forces in a counterforce strike. So, you know, if, for example, the Russia or the Chinese have, four ICBM silos that can be struck with one weapon. And let's say each of those Chinese ICBMs has six warheads. So, you know, six times four is 24 warheads on four delivery platforms. If you can take it out with one American weapon, then you really only need one. So one takes out four, which holds 24. And so strategic sufficiency essentially says, you know, you don't necessarily need a one-for-one ratio. But part of why we want that one-for-one ratio is because we think we're trying to create understanding in the mind of our adversary.
So Adam, that's a great place to take a break. We're going to be right back on NucleCast and dig more into this fascinating topic. Thank you.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
Okay, we're back on NucleCast with Dr. Adam Lowther, a fascinating conversation about nuclear deterrence. So one of the things that you talk about in your article is the need to be transparent with our adversaries as to what we are doing so that they don't misinterpret or there's no ambiguity. So could you talk a little bit about the danger of ambiguity and then why it's important to be so crystal clear in your communications?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, this is really a challenge with autocratic regimes. This was always a challenge with the Soviets. When we would be very direct and straightforward with the Soviets, and we were 100% truthful with them, they absolutely thought we were lying. Well, why did they think we were lying? Because they were lying. And they were like, hey, wait a second. We are lying. And we would never give this kind of information out. That's something we would never do. So therefore, they have to be lying to us. And that's the challenge. But one of the things you can do is, you know, we've got really good, you know, overhead surveillance, and we've got really good intelligence gathering capabilities. And so there's ways that we are available today to sort of vet the truth and vet, you know, action. I mean, Open Skies was about this. You know, we had capabilities to do that. And so the idea here is that this idea that strategic ambiguity, which we sort of always had, that just more strategic ambiguity is always better. And our premise is no, it's not. Particularly if you're trying to say, hey, you know, you go up, we go up, you go down, we go down. And so for that to actually work, you have to minimize the amount of ambiguity that you produce. And so you want to, I mean, you're not going to tell your adversary everything and you're not going to show them everything, but you want them to essentially believe that when you say you go up, we go up, you go down, we go down, that they actually believe that you'll do that and that you're not just seeking advantage by sort of tricking them into going down.
Got it. So you offer some recommendations as to what the U.S. should be doing to, you know, move to a dynamic parity approach. Can you talk through those recommendations for us?
Yeah, so dynamic parity, I mean, essentially we're arguing that the U.S. nuclear arsenal has to grow and grow rather dramatically because, you know, the Russians have, we think they still are within the New START limits, but they have at least 2,000 non-strategic nuclear weapons. We don't have those. So we would have to produce a couple thousand just to match those non-strategic weapons of the Russians. And we don't have the war, you know, we have older pits that we have in storage, but this would not be an easy task. So one of the first things we're going to have to do is we have to actually get, you know, the NNSA and the labs to be capable of building pits and of doing the kind of manufacturing and other work that the labs were able to do during the Cold War. And that's going to mean that we're going to have, you know, there's regulations that the president can waive, particularly on federal lands. You know, we may undertake all of these sort of environmental surveys and all. But on federal lands, the president can waive that. And he can say, hey, this is a national security imperative. He can, the Industrial Relations Act can be enacted, and we can make these things a lot faster than they are. And I think you're going to have to do that because the NNSA and its, and its manufacturing and design labs just can't produce what we need. And they're really not getting, to the point where they can produce 80 pits a year. That's a problem. Whereas the Russians are producing 1,000 pits a year. We're going to have to do better. And then you're going to have to build a manufacturing and industrial base. These are, the primes who know what they're doing. I mean, part of the reason we have problems with Sentinel is because this hasn't been done. I mean, the last time we built silos in the ground was in the 1960s. I don't know that anybody's even alive that built a silo. So we've got to get better at doing this, and we've got to, sort of develop the talent and then maintain the talent. And part of what we want to do is we want to sort of build the capability and just make it part of what we do. And that is to, replace, have this consistent, every decade, we replace existing weapons with new capabilities, or, maybe we're replacing some ICBMs, we're going to replace them with hypersonics. We're always upgrading, and we're demonstrating to our adversary that this matters, that we're taking it seriously, and that we're not going to allow you to gain advantage over us. And so that means you're going to have to make investment. Part of what that means is you're going to have to shift the focus of the defense budget. In an essentially a $900 billion defense budget, right now, you're spending 5 or 6% on, the nuclear modernization program. Well, you're going to have to spend more. So you're going to have to reprioritize the defense budget. And so where we have, if you go back to the Cold War, Strategic Air Command alone received half of the defense budget at certain points of time during the Cold War. They got half the defense budget, just SAC. We knew what our priority was. And I think it's time where we say, hey, these are the kinds of conflicts and wars we're not going to fight. And here are the things we are going to prioritize. So that's part of what you also have to do. And then sort of in the immediate part of what I would submit is that we have to put bombers back on alert. And this is something I argued in an article in Breaking Defense recently, is you got to put bombers back on alert, which would be an abject failure because we don't have the crews, the security forces, the maintainers, our aerial refueling fleet that, the bombers require. And of course the cops, the crews, all they can't do it. So, it's something that needs to be done, but we just don't have what it takes to do it. And remember, we have a bomber force today that is 1/10 the size it was in 1991. And we kept bombers on alert, for over 12,400 straight days during the Cold War. And that was when it was 10 times larger. And now we can't do it for even a short period. So we've really got to get ourselves together and start to build a nuclear force and the delivery vehicles and the capabilities that we need to make this work. Because our adversaries are serious. And we have this misconception that, if we just keep doing what we're doing because we mean them no harm, that therefore they'll leave us alone. And, but I that's just not how, autocrats think. I mean, they came to power by killing people and by, harming others. So therefore they do that to their own people. Why would we think they'd have a problem doing it to us?
Great question. So we're kind of at the point in the program where we only have a few minutes left, but you've established the three wishes paradigm. So Dr. Adam Lowther, what are your three wishes when it comes to this topic?
Okay, so my three wishes. Number one is sort of a big, broad wish. I want the American citizenry to have a debate, a guns versus butter debate. We have to have a guns versus butter debate because we simply cannot keep borrowing money to give it away. I mean, if you look at like COVID relief funds, which this was, you know, $4 trillion, most of it went overseas. It was mostly fraudulently spent, but it was money that has caused inflation and it's been harmful. We've got to actually start spending what the, you know, what we make. I mean, the federal, state, and local governments already collect, you know, almost $10 trillion a year, but we're spending far more than that. So we need to have an open guns versus butter debate and say, hey, there are certain things domestically we can't do and we just can't borrow to do them. And then we have a real adversary who wants us to cause us harm. And we're going to have to focus on countering that adversary. So that's wish number one. Have that debate. It hasn't been had in decades. Wish number two, you know, we have to have a hard discussion inside the DOD. And we make everything important. You know, we want to have, you know, we want to be able to fight conventional capabilities. We're kind of saying, well, we want to focus on the China fight. But yet we don't build the capabilities that are really good for the China fight. So we've got to, you know, really say, okay, we're going to care about China. We're going to care about nuclear. And then we've got to, you know, start prioritizing the kinds of things that are important. And then, you know, perhaps the third thing is I would like to put in law that before the United States ever uses force, it has to answer the questions in the Weinberger Doctrine. Because if we had to address the questions in the Weinberger Doctrine, we would rethink how we used American force. And in many respects, we would use it less, which therefore would save us a lot of money. And of course, that money could be spent more wisely. And hopefully we would borrow less, which of course, you know, I want a strong and prosperous American economy, because that's the only way you can afford the kinds of capabilities I'm suggesting we buy. So that's kind of the three things that I would wish for. You know, they're sort of big, broad wishes, but that's sort of where I'm at.
Well, you're a strategic thinker and a great leading voice for the nuclear deterrence policy of the United States. A dynamic parody, a new approach to American nuclear deterrence. It's a great read. It's very thought-provoking. Hope everyone can take a look at it. And Dr. Adam Lowther, thank you very much for coming back to your show and being our guest, and hopefully being the host again here real soon. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Jim. It was good to be here.
Take care.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at Nuclecast.